According to the National Spinal Cord Injury Association, at least 7,000 Americans suffer spinal cord injuries each year. There's currently no way to reverse spinal cord damage, and often the result is permanent paralysis. When a close friend from high school broke his neck playing football, Jennifer Morgan promised him she'd do what she could to improve our understanding of spinal cord injuries and maybe even work toward a treatment. Dr. Jennifer Morgan is an assistant scientist in the new Eugene Bell Center for Regenerative Biology and Tissue Engineering at MBL. She studies nerve cell repair and communication in sea lampreys. She joins us this morning to talk about what she's learning and what it might mean for those living with spinal cord injuries. Welcome, Jen.
Thank you. Good morning.
With more than 250,000 Americans, again, this is according to the National Spinal Cord Injury Association, living with spinal cord injuries, there's clearly a compelling reason to study these. But you have a very personal connection to your research, a close friend who actually was injured in a football accident and permanently paralyzed. So that really influenced the direction of your research. I wonder if you'd tell us a little bit of that story.
Sure, absolutely. So my friend Jason was injured as a sophomore in high school. He had been fortunate enough and successful enough that he was on the varsity team already. And the backstory to this was that he had had an injury to his shoulder and he was not yet released from the doctor, and he convinced the coach to let him in. So probably he was positioning his neck and his body wrong when he took a hit on the second play of the game and was immediately paralyzed at age 14. He hadn't even learned how to drive yet.
Wow.
So I got a phone call from my best friend. This is his sister when I was, again, a sophomore in college. And she was very upset and she told me what had happened. And, you know, honestly, we thought he was going to die. He broke his spinal cord in right up in the neck in one of the cervical vertebrae. Ordinarily, when people have a severe injury like this, they're unable to breathe on his own, but somehow Jason was able to breathe on his own, and probably that's part of what saved him, and he got to very good care very quickly. So fast forwarding through a number of surgeries and, you know, a number of lawsuits, became this really incredible, or he continued to be a really incredible person. This person ended up finishing high school. He ended up going to college. He was a business owner. He got into trouble like every teenager would, and was quite an inspiration. And so at some point I had now moved on into graduate school. I was at Duke University in the neurobiology department working on my degree, and I had gone home and visited Jason as I did every time I went home. And he said to me, now that you're working in neurobiology and on synaptic transmission, which is the process by which neurons communicate with one another in the brain and the spinal cord, he said, could you please, if you get a chance, work on spinal cord injury and maybe you could do something to help me. And I should say another thing that was so inspirational about Jason is that he would take some of these experimental treatments. And so he was one of the first people in North Carolina to receive the electrical field stimulator in his shoulder that was, you know, could control some hand movements. I mean, he was constantly reading literature, reading primary literature. And so he was quite an inspiration. And I made him that promise. And a few years ago was able to get into the field of spinal cord injury and keep that promise to him.
I mean, what was that moment like for you when this, you know, you're just getting into research and it seems like that could be very flattering, but at the same time, very overwhelming to have a close friend of yours asking, I mean, essentially, can you try to help me? Can you try to find a treatment or a cure for this this injury that I've had?
I think Jason was really very realistic about research and that it's a long-term process and that you're in it for the long haul and that things that you learn in the laboratory now, may take several to many years. And, you know, but he, you know, continued to be encouraging and, you know, try new treatments himself. And, you know, I think his goal always was for the next person.
As the parent of three boys, I know I'm always saying to them, don't do that, you're going to break your neck. And that's, you know, I'm not sure that my kids get that. But for me, that's a totally different class of injury than any other kind of injury. The kind of story you're telling about Jason, while it obviously has a very inspiring, not an end yet, but, is still this tragedy that I think a lot of parents and a lot of people fear, breaking your neck or breaking your back. Why are these injuries so debilitating? Why are they so different from any other injury that our bodies are pretty well able to repair, and these we just don't seem able to handle?
Yeah, so the big issue is that in humans, in the brain and spinal cord, if you suffer a severe injury, the nervous system isn't able to easily repair itself, unlike if you cut your finger and the skin can repair itself and many other tissues in the body. And so, you know, that's one of the big reasons why, you know, people are trying to figure out how you can encourage the brain and spinal cord to undergo some amount of repair. And for many, many years, until I would say maybe within the past 10 to 15 years, everyone thought that once you mature into an adult, your nervous system now is no longer plastic, and that's it. However, over the last 5 to 8 years, people have discovered using experimental models in the laboratory that, in fact, there are some pathways in the brain and the spinal cord that, when injured, do mount a growth response, a new regeneration response. That is to say, the neurons in the brain and spinal cord can start to grow back. And so now there's this, you know, new excitement in the field to try to figure out how you could sort of harness that new growth and make it more and make it better and make it reconnect in a way that's meaningful to the function of the human.
That's really cool. I mean, that seems very optimistic and very different from kind of what the dogma has always been, that humans can't repair nerve damage pretty much at all. So that's very exciting to hear that that's possible. But I mean, in the rest of the animal kingdom, it is possible. There are a lot of different animals that can regenerate nerve cells partially or even completely, right?
That's right. That's right.
I mean, you've said that it's very common in invertebrates. And I love the way you described it to me the other day, was that as the ability kind of disappears as you go up the evolutionary chain. So the more complex and evolved the animal is, the less their ability to repair nerve damage. And that seems almost counterintuitive. Do we have any sense of why that is?
Oh, that's a great question that so many people would like to know the answer to. So, you know, the prevalent thought in the field is that, as the nervous system became more complex, as you move up the evolutionary chain, then we somehow, you know, lost the ability to repair and regenerate. And why that is completely unknown. And in fact, you know, this is sort of serves as one of the kind of primary basis for our research. That is to say, we work on an organism, the sea lamprey, that is able to regenerate and recover full movements out after a complete spinal cord transection, which is a very severe injury. And so why can this vertebrate do it and we cannot? And that's really, I would say, one of the, you know, take home messages and the big questions that lots of people in the field, including my lab, are trying to go after.
I'm talking with Dr. Jennifer Morgan this morning about her research on nerve cell regeneration in sea lampreys. If you'd like to add your question or comment to our conversation, you can do so by giving us a call at 866-999-4626 or email us at livinglabradio@wgbh.org. You can also tweet us at livinglabradio. So let's talk about the sea lamprey for a minute.
Okay.
Just describe for everybody what a sea lamprey actually looks like. It's kind of this eel-like fish, right?
It is. So it's basically a long, primitive fish. And we get these animals out of the Great Lakes regions. They're also here in New England. You can collect them from the Holyoke Dam up in Maine and several other regions. And they're long and skinny, and they look like an eel, and they swim like in an S shape, like a sinusoidal back and forth type of movement. They have a single dorsal fin. They have gills. At the stage that we like to study them, they are called late larval stage animals, but even though they're called larvae, which implies that they're young animals, these animals actually undergo a very long, protracted larval state. So the animals we work on are 5 to 7 years old.
Oh.
They're wild-caught, and they do have a very mature nervous system.
So why the sea lamprey in particular? Why not any other fish to do this kind of work?
Okay, so that's a really good question. So the sea lamprey actually, you know, is one of the most basal evolved vertebrates. It evolved from a common chordate ancestor about 550 million years ago, but it has a true brain and a true spinal cord, and it has in its spinal cord some of the analogous structures to some of the neural networks in our spinal cord that control the walking movements. So they have some basic circuits in the spinal cord that control their swimming, and it's wired up similarly to walking in humans. So that's one reason. They have these broadly analogous brain and spinal cord structures, and so that gives us kind of a home base for, you know, looking at different types of plasticity and rebuilding of the nervous system in structures that are meaningful to higher vertebrates, including humans. The other reason, of course, that we use them is because they fully recover after spinal cord injury. That is to say, after the complete transection, they are immediately paralyzed, but then over the course of 10 to 12 weeks, they're able to recover their ability to swim to a degree that if you put an injured, recovered animal in a tank next to an uninjured control animal, you cannot tell the difference by eye. They both swim around again. They both swim with the sinusoidal movement. They're moving around really fast. And so it's a really compelling thing to watch these animals recover over the time course of a couple of months. And it's so robust and it's so reproducible, and it happens in every animal with very little variability. And so it's because of the robustness of this phenomenon that we like to use the organism. And then the third reason is because the lampreys have these large identified neurons that are found in every single animal that we can study with great detail. They regenerate. We're studying how they reconnect to their downstream partners, how they talk to each other again, and we can keep looking at these same neurons and sort of get at the cellular basis of the recovery.
When you say they're a big neuron, I mean, how big are we talking? You know, the lampreys you're using are what, several inches long at this stage? And I mean, I know there are some neurons that nerve cells that, like, the giraffe has one that's, what, 15 feet long or something like that. Nerve cells can get really, really big,
exactly.
But most of the time we think of a cell as being very tiny and microscopic. So give us some scale here. What are we talking about?
So the scale of these particular neurons that we like to study, so these are the reticulospinal neurons. They're found in the brain of the lamprey, and they project down into the spinal cord. So these neurons on a scale, you know, basically the neurons are about 100 to 200 microns in diameter. And to give you a scale, a typical neuron in another vertebrate experimental model might be more like 5 to 10 microns. So, you know, what does that mean practically? It means that you can open up the animal, you can look at the brain under a very simple dissecting microscope, and you can see it. They look like little clusters of grapes that you can pick out, and you can name them because they're in the same location in every single animal.
So obviously, to study spinal cord injuries, you have to give them an injury. And I'm curious, what does this look like when you take a fish, you say you transect the spinal cord, so you're cutting the spinal cord. What does this poor animal look like after you've done that? And then how do you take them through recovery?
So luckily, again, it's very robust and it's very reproducible. So what we actually do is we anesthetize the animal, and then we make a small incision on the dorsal side of the animal, that's on their back. And we go through the skin, we go through a layer of fat, a layer of muscle, and then we reach the spinal cord. In the lamprey, the spinal cord and the brain are encased not in bones, but in a cartilage casing. So what we do is we snip through that cartilage casing and through the spinal cord once. And you can confirm the transection by eye, because basically you can see the two halves of the spinal cord kind of pull apart a little bit, because in the organism the spinal cord is under a little bit of a tension. And then what we do at that point is simply suture the animal back up, put it back in the tank, and we monitor the behavioral recovery over the next 10 to 12 weeks. They miraculously start swimming again, so they are able to move forward and swim again within 2 to 3 weeks.
But so for 2 or 3 weeks, they're basically just laying on the bottom of an aquarium.
Yep,
the equivalent of being paralyzed.
That's right. So they, for 1 week, they're in that state. They wiggle their head. Then about two to three weeks into the recovery process, they're able to start moving forward. But you can observe that their swimming movements are not normal. That, you know, maybe they're swimming better in one direction than the other, or they're not able to turn themselves upright. You know, you can observe that they're able to move, but it's not quite normal. And then by 10 to 12 weeks, they're doing, so far, all of the things, you know, we've observed them able to recover all of the things that the lampreys do. They're able to burrow again into the mud. They're able to swim. They turn right. They turn left. They're able to, if they turn upside down, they're able to right themselves. And so you had asked, to go back to your previous question, you had asked, well, why lampreys and not other fish? So other types of fish are pretty good at regeneration, but we, you know, for our purposes, it's the combined robustness of the recovery process itself, along with these giant identified neurons that regenerate, that we can really start to study at the cellular and molecular level, that makes a good case for the lampreys, for our questions.
Do you have any idea how somebody first discovered that lampreys have this ability? I mean, you know, were scientists just going around trying to find a great model for spinal cord injury and giving different fish spinal cord injuries? Or was this an accident? How on earth did we ever figure out that sea lampreys could do this?
Actually, that's a great question, and one that I really don't know the answer to. I mean, there were several pioneering people in the field. One was Carl Ravinen, was really kind of one of the major pioneers who discovered that these axons can regenerate, and he published a few seminal papers in the late 1960s that continue to be really amazing resources for people in the field now. But what made him and, you know, a few people before him decide to try this is is not known to me. I have no idea.
So they recover fully within 10 to 12 weeks at the level of behavior, this kind of gross level where you can see, okay, the animal is swimming around, he or she is burrowing, doing those kinds of normal things. But you also know that not every nerve cell that has been injured actually recovers, right?
That's
it's only
right.
About 50% of them that actually repair, and the other 50% die.
So let me interject one thing before we move into sort of the differences of the different cell types that regenerate and don't. But I should say, as I did a couple of times, that these animals are able to recover fully by eye. But if you actually do special things like video them and do measurements of other types of parameters like swimming speed and other things like that, you can pick out that they're not perfect. And that is to say, there are still some deficits in the biggest one that we've identified so far quantitatively is the swimming speed. So they don't swim as fast, but you can't really tell that by eye. So there are some deficits. So that means that, you know, in terms of a model, if we can develop and find ways to improve it, we still have parameters that we can measure for improving the recovery process above and beyond what they're able to do spontaneously. So, you know, well, why is it that they're not perfect? And so you raised, you know, the next point, which is that within the nervous system, within these, you know, classified neurons, the reticulospinal neurons, a subset of them reproducibly regenerates, while another subset of them reproducibly dies after the injury. And these can be neighboring cells side by side. And actually, this is one of the big questions that we're starting to go after now, which is, in this intact vertebrate organism, you know, if you kind of look at the basic cellular level, what is it that is the molecular recipe that decides whether one, you know, neuron is going to survive the injury and regenerate its axon and reconnect versus one that's going to die? So that's one of the big questions that we're starting to go after here at the MBL.
So it's not reproducibly the same cells, or it's not just, you know, if it gets a certain type of injury, it can't recover. It is
the same cells. It's reproducibly the same cells. So they all have, you know, names within, you know, within the brain. So I mentioned that they're in stereotypical locations, and some of the cells are in the hind brain, and they have names like bulbar neurons and Mothner neurons. And the Mothner neuron, for example, reproducibly does not regenerate, while some of the bulbar neurons, you know, for example, B4, B5, as examples, reproducibly do regenerate.
Cool.
So we can look in a normal brain of a lamprey and pre-identify which ones are going to have the best chance for regenerating and which ones are most likely to die.
So knowing that, I mean, that's kind of power in and of itself. But in order to actually translate that into, you know, being able to figure out why some do, why some don't, and then possibly turning that into treatments, you've got to be able to understand these processes not just at the cellular level, but at the genetic level, really getting into what makes the cells do what they're doing. So
that's
how do you do that? How do you start to tease apart what's going on at the genetic level?
So these are some of the experiments that we're starting to get into now. And, you know, I guess the first question that you might ask is, you know, here are these two types of cells, the good regenerators and the poor regenerators. Do they start out different? That's kind of the first question. That is to say, if you can extract the genetic material from these guys and look at all the genes that are being expressed in good versus poor survivors, they may start out at different transcriptional levels. They may start out expressing different subsets of genes. The alternative is that they may all express the same genes, but then respond differently in terms of the changes in gene expression after injury. And so that's what, you know, that's one of the compelling reasons that brought me to MBL, because there are lots of people who are doing these types of gene expression studies, doing deep sequencing to figure out all of the different genes that are being expressed or not. And so we can start to, you know, look at different time points after injury and start to ask these kinds of questions. And again, you know, the fact that these cells are large, that we can identify them in every animal, or and also that it's a vertebrate, you know, gives us a real lead and a real advantage for these types of questions that we want to ask.
So when you say you're doing deep sequencing, I mean, this isn't like genome sequencing, because obviously all these cells have the same genome, they have the same DNA, but it's which genes they're turning on and off that you're trying to figure out.
That's right.
Right. So you've actually had some success in doing this already. And I know about a year ago you published, I think it was about a year ago, you published a paper announcing that you'd found one protein called synapsin, obviously named because it's part of the nerve cell synapse, where it's the connection between cells. And that seems to be changing as the lamprey regenerates, and you thought might be a good target for looking at whether or not something can be done with that in humans.
Yeah. So, you know, to summarize what we found, basically, you know, these efforts and some of the interesting molecules that we've found so far have been after, you know, a more of a candidate approach. That is to say, we have ideas about molecules that should be involved, and so we specifically go and look at them. And we're hoping then that the deep sequencing is going to give us, you know, clues for new molecules that we wouldn't think of. So I just wanted to, you know, clarify that one little point. But this interesting molecule, synapsin, is a protein that's expressed in all vertebrates. And during development, it's involved in basically, you know, you have a neuron and it's got to grow out cell processes that become axons and dendrites.
So by processes, you don't mean processes that are happening. You mean like,
extensions,
right?
Extensions.
Yeah, it's like
yes.
Grows.
Exactly.
Like fingers or something.
Yeah, exactly. It grows out little fingers, extensions, and connections. And this protein, synapsin, is involved in this neurite outgrowth during development. And so, you know, many things that it's able to do is to support the addition of membrane into these processes so that you can grow the extension longer and longer and longer. And so you might then this is one thing that a lot of people in the regenerative biology field do, is sort of look back at development and say, what's happening during development that allows for growth of neurons? And could we identify some of these genes being turned on again in a meaningful way that supports regrowth? So synapsin is probably one of them. So what we discovered is that after you cut the spinal cord in the lamprey, this protein synapsin goes way up in terms of its levels, and that, you know, would be indicative of, you know, something that could support more growth, more neurites to grow out during the regenerative process, similarly to what it does during development.
So synapsin is one possibility. You've got some other interesting ones that you've come up with, one that's actually connected to Parkinson's disease, I guess?
Yeah, we have another really interesting molecule that we discovered, and this protein is called synuclein. And synuclein actually was named first because it was found at synapses and the nucleus, so synuclein. And what we discovered is that when you cut the spinal cord of the lamprey and you sever these neurons, the ones that go on to die are the ones that will accumulate this protein called synuclein. So they accumulate lots of the protein, and that happens before the poor regenerators go on to die. And then the good regenerators do not accumulate this protein, and those are the ones that go on to regenerate. So the good survivors and the good regenerators don't accumulate it, and the poorer ones do. And so what's interesting, you know, about this is that this accumulation of this protein called synuclein happens in an age-dependent manner in Parkinson's disease. And so we've discovered now that injury can cause accumulation of this protein. And, you know, this gives us some clues that there may be some parallels between the degenerative processes in Parkinson's disease and, you know, after injury. And so obviously the next set of experiments to do is to prevent that accumulation and see if you can then spare the neurons, keep them from dying, and then turn a poor regenerator into a good one.
So which one might be easier? I mean, you've got the synapsin, which is possibly something that you would want to turn on or make more of to regenerate. And you've got the synuclein that you would actually maybe want to turn off to prevent something from dying. Which one might be, do you have any sense which one might be the better or easier treatment, turning one on or turning one off?
Well, I can say no, you know, in terms of the biology, I don't know which one would be easier at this point, but I can say we're actively pursuing the synuclein project and we have some promising results.
So you go back, you said you still keep in touch with Jason, the friend of yours who broke his neck. When you tell him about these new discoveries, I'm assuming you tell him about these discoveries, what is his response to these kind of, you know, it's small incremental steps that you're making in the lab? What is his response to those?
So this is actually, it's both a lovely and also a sad story. So Jason actually passed away last November. He lived for 20 plus years after his spinal cord injury. And like I said, had, you know, led this really incredible, very full life. But I've been in touch with him, you know, I was in touch with him, you know, the whole time. And he was very encouraged by, you know, our progress and the progress in the field in the laboratory. And of course, I'm in touch with his family. And they are like all very inspirational people. And, you know, they put a lot of their own efforts into, you know, into keeping up with the research and being encouraging to other people.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that he passed away, but that sounds like that's a real inspiration for you to keep going and doing this. I mean, you said you need something to kind of keep you going sometimes when things are going slowly in the lab, and that sounds like it's probably a real inspiration for you.
It is. It's a very compelling reason, to see such a success story for somebody who probably shouldn't have made it, who then went on to get several degrees, own a business, and be quite successful as a person is inspirational.
Dr. Jennifer Morgan is an assistant scientist in the Eugene Bell Center for Regenerative Biology and Tissue Engineering at MBL, where she studies nerve cell repair and communication in sea lampreys. Thanks so much for being here, Jen.
And thanks for giving me the opportunity to share our work.
Absolutely. You can find out more about Jen's research, including a video of one of her recovering sea lampreys, on our website. That's www.wgbh.org/livinglabradio. This is Living Lab on the Point. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab on the Point is produced by Heather Goldstone. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. Living Lab on the Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.